have many different types of perspectives here, so I'm going to allow each of the panelists to introduce themselves. And then we're going to sort of start on the big picture questions, and we're going to go down to the micro and sort of understand the actual nitty-gritty of this stuff, right? So we're just going to assume, you know, blockchain and AI. So why don't we start at the very end over there? Oh, so my name is Jim Liu. I'm a professor here. I teach the Big Data Machine Learning course. We're going to offer the first blockchain course for Johns Hopkins Kerry Business School in the fall. And I have a small machine learning AI company called SoCat. So we'll start with David.
My name is David Martins. Everything I know about machine learning and blockchain, I learned from Dr. Liu. So everything I'm wrong, you can blame on him. I'm vice president at Novell Technologies. We're based here in Tyson's Corner in Rockville, Maryland. We do a lot of work with the National Institutes of Health on biomedical research. And I think I'm here today because we do a lot of work with federal grants. So we manage the largest federal grant management platform, which is called grantsolutions.gov. You may not know a lot about federal grants. I didn't until I got into it, but there's over $700 billion a year spent on investing in communities through federal grants. There's a huge process that supports that. So I started getting involved with AI, machine learning, and blockchain because we're trying to figure out how can we do that smarter.
Hi everybody, I'm Kathleen Walsh. I'm a senior analyst at Cognilytica, which is an AI-focused analyst and advisory firm. I'm also the host of the popular AI Today podcast, where we talk about all things related to artificial intelligence, and as well we have a lot of guest speakers on the subject. I've also been involved with the technology and entrepreneurial and startup ecosystem for a long time. I've run a lot of technology events, including investor events, as well as expos and demo events as well. I'm excited to be on this panel.
Also, Kathleen and Ron said I was raising your hand. They have this wonderful podcast on blockchains and AI that they'll provide a link afterwards if you're interested.
Hi everyone, my name is Reema Z. I'm a UX UI designer in the data analytics space at Deloitte. But what I'm going to talk to you guys about today is actually what I do, what my night job is. Essentially what I do is educate people on blockchain through my DC blockchain meetup. We started off at a small group of like 200 members, and now it's grown to like 2,800 members over the past 2 years. So it's been really exciting growth, especially with blockchain being the new buzzword. Before I joined Deloitte, I was actually the lead designer at a fintech blockchain startup. It was a really exciting time to kind of get into that space a little over a year ago. But right now I'm just focused on my education for the most part.
Cool. My name is Jose Arrieta. I am the Associate Deputy Assistant Secretary for Acquisition of HHS, responsible for about $27 billion, $26 billion a year in contract expenditure across the U.S. in the healthcare space. I think why Jim invited me is I did a POC with blockchain, a job that I had before that, basically using blockchain as a data layer, running machine learning, tying into intelligence off the data layer. All the crypto guys in the room will likely probably disagree with me, but I actually think that's the model. I think crypto is just a fad that will go away, and at some point you won't actually need currency. And I think that's the model to actually leverage this technology. I say that to make someone mad as well. But I think that's the model to leverage this technology. And I'm actually doing an implementation at HHS. I've been at HHS for about 3 months. And I'm going to start one at HHS very soon. I'll talk a little bit about that. I learned about blockchain at the Department of Treasury. I worked for the Deputy Secretary. There is a strategic interest from a policy level in blockchain technology because it impacts a number of the structures that the United States manages as an entity. Globally, and that's where I first was exposed to blockchain and looking at blockchain more than a provider of or a purveyor of currency and looking at it as a utility that could be used in other spaces.
So Jose is, he doesn't really brag because he's a humble person, but of all the people in the government, all the people in the different agencies, he's the first person to ever implement a real blockchain solution that's in production right now. So because I always tell my students this, whenever you find a pioneer, chances are they're going to continue to pioneer, sort of like Elon Musk, right? So we're going to see a lot more sort of innovation from Jose, I'm sure, going forward. So he used to work at GSA, now he's moved to HHS. So now he's going to talk about it. He's going to launch probably HHS's first blockchain solution, right?
Yeah, I mean, I expect to have it done. For those of you that understand government, I expect to have an authority to operate by September. So So the proof that we built at GSA, I believe that I will be, the proof that I built at GSA, which I left, I think that the HHS proof that we built will be in production before GSA decides how to scale. The proof that we built there a few months ago.
Why would they let you go?
Maybe we'll talk about that.
A new way to store that information, but then, as we all know, be able to distribute it and manage it more efficiently than what we currently have in place. And I'm also on several groups here in Washington, D.C. with the Smart Cities Group, the Government Blockchain Association, and the third portion, the third leg of my school, is working with Voice AI. Because I see all three of those, the voice and blockchain specifically, as being key to improving government. And these are not fantasies anymore. This is what we can do today, and hopefully we'll talk about that in a bit. What else did I miss?
Thank you very much, Michael. Okay, so we're gonna just jump straight into this discussion, sort of talk about the US. So the US collected $3.3 trillion. That's $1 trillion. I come from the hedge fund industry, and $1 billion is a lot. I never got to say $1 trillion until I sort of came to, you know, the Ivy Tower. So $3.3 trillion in the fiscal year 2016. So I want to know, you know, I'm thinking about this, and, you know, how much can we save the taxpayers? Are we talking about something that's 10%? Is it 20%, 30%? Maybe this whole blockchains and AI is just another technology fad. And we're actually going to spend more money, and, you know, we're not going to save anything. We're going to go out and we're going to do all these projects and waste, you know, taxpayers' dollars, right? So I'm just kind of curious, you know, before I sort of, you know, say where I think that is, right, 10, 20, 30, 50%, I'm curious to hear sort of what your thoughts are on, you know, how do you sort of think about that? How do you estimate that? And, you know, so what do you guys, anyone can jump in anytime.
So from my perspective, I don't work with big government quite yet. I do most of my work with the communities and the cities. And even if they can save 5 to 10%, that's huge. You know, a trillion is a nice number. How many cities here have trillion-dollar budgets? A few, but the majority of them don't. So even saving that, you know, 5 to 10% can literally make their citizens very happy. So I see that really where we can make the difference. The earlier speaker talked about start at the top. That's absolutely true. You know, you gotta talk to the mayors, talk to the city councils, and educate them on what they can do with the technology. Is it a trend? Yes, because all technologies by definition are evolving and are a trend. But we can't go back and say, oh, we're gonna forget that and go back to the old system. So I think we're on the right spot, on the right track. We just have to work with, what do they call it? Oh yeah, the federal government, to get on board with this and let the communities and the states push this forward like they're doing in the states. Arizona's doing it, Vermont's doing it, Wisconsin, Chicago, Delaware, any other states you guys can, they're doing this now to save money.
Yeah, I mean, I let economists do estimates. I, quite frankly, don't care. The way that I look at it is, no, seriously, right? So the way that I look at blockchain and the way that I started to learn about it, if you think about it, if you transfer money from the United States to Mexico, right, Bank of Mexico, Bank of the United States, there's always a third-party rationalization. That's about 40% of the total cost, right, especially with KYC rules. So what blockchain allows you to actually do is to cut out that third piece of the stool, and you can lower your cost by 40%. So when I look at it, I look at it at the project level. I'll let an economist estimate what they're going to save, and I'll just give you guys a real-world example. In the implementation and the proof that I did at GSA, I took blockchain, I layered it over 22 different systems. I didn't functionally change any of those systems. I put blockchain over the top of them and let my aging, dying, old infrastructure, I'm not calling you I let it stay there. And then I used robotic processing automation, APIs, to actually rationalize data and bring it on-chain. I used Hyperledger Fabric, just so you guys get an example. Then what I did is I went one business process at a time, and I built machine learning and cognitive intelligence as a microservice off of my blockchain. I was able to actually look at an aging, dying system and use microservices to optimize that business process, number one, directly off the chain in real time. I then could go and retire those aging systems. So once we actually proved that that model worked and we proved it, that it was functional, we said, okay, well, how much of the aging infrastructure can we retire? And what would be the time savings, right? Because I went from, and your UI UX designer will tell you this, I went from a process that was driven by system constraints. I have six applications piled on top of one another. If I add two decimal points to the sixth application out, I need to add two decimal points to all of the applications in between. I need to run IBM on that entire network. I need to ensure that it works. That's extremely costly to do that. When I'm operating on a data layer, I just build a microservice for what I need. If I don't need that microservice anymore, I deconstruct it and I can build another microservice. I can open up my data layer to a user to build a microservice for whatever they need, right? This is a different way of thinking about blockchain than the crypto, you know, just designing a cryptocurrency, designing Bitcoin, whatever. So, conservative estimate, we cut out 90% of our OPEX for that business process that we tagged. 90% of our OPEX. And 90% of the time associated with evaluating a company and giving them a contract. So we thought we could take the time from 110 days to 10 days. And actually, that was what I would say publicly. But behind the scenes, I thought we could take it to a matter of hours, assuming that the negotiating, the pricing position that the company brought in was a reasonable pricing position. I didn't have to negotiate.
Do you have pushback, though, from people that you can want to do this, but everybody on this table says, well, I want my stuff.
Well, we did it. So it's like, it's not like we wanted to do it. We actually, I can email you the proof and you can take a look at it. You know, there's no voiceover because we didn't have enough money to actually do the recording, a voiceover that explains what's going on. But I think if you watch it, you'll understand what we did. Now the pushback comes internally when you're looking at, when you go to your CIO and you say, look, I don't think I need 90% of your support. Because I want to get off these legacy systems. It's business process driven. I'm going, right? So it depends on the organization you work in, and you have to figure out how to manage that. We can get into that a little bit later. But I don't know what the macro number is. I just know that if you're focused on executing and you're looking at a specific business process and you take that approach, there's significant savings and you make life better for the user because you're redesigning all the user interfaces on how they behave, not what they tell you they do. Because what you tell me you do is very different than what you do.
Yeah, I agree, jumping in on that. I think that, you know, there is a cost savings and it's tremendous what it can be, but you do need adoption. And so you can't go and say, oh, well, I think I'm gonna cut 90% of your workforce, because that doesn't always, you know, translate favorably. And I know that there's been a lot of talk about how artificial intelligence can take away jobs and people are afraid of that. So, you know, you have to be mindful of that as well, because yeah, there can be a cost savings there, but what's the benefit and are people gonna be on board with that? But I do see that there can be tremendous value.
So let me just say one thing about it, sorry, but the people, right? So people would say, what about my job?
Yeah.
First they would say, can I click through the system? Well, no, because we automate it. You can check the data that was entered, and you can check that the calculation at the output was correct, but there's nothing to click through. And then they would say, what about our jobs? I said, do you really like logging into 22 different systems? Do you like to do all of the copying and pasting you do to create one Word document that's required by federal law to do X? Because that's the piece of your job that I'm getting rid of.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that's the key point. We talk about cost reductions and how much money can we save, but the reality is the better focus may be on value delivered. How much can we increase the value delivered? So when you're filing your taxes, you know, okay, would it be better if the IRS was spending less money on overhead and those sorts of things? Yeah, but it might be even better if you do it like that and there's no pain and there's no lag for you to get your big refund and you know, all those sorts of things.
Or you can find out the pain sooner.
Yes, well,
yeah.
Well, let's look at the possibility.
But no, I mean that seriously as well as jokingly, that if there's an error, I want to know about it now, not in 4 to 6 to 12 weeks when they finally send me the letter saying, oh, sorry, we meant to ask you for Form 12, not Form 15. My perspective as well is from digital transformation, that big, huge strategy concept of how can we use current digital technologies to save time and money, make the customer experience better, and potentially come up with new, using AI, new business-driven, data-driven processes. That's the key. And I mean, it works for government, it works in the private sector. True.
Okay, so it sounds like we might have consensus. You see,
I'm 51%.
that we could save using blockchains and AI on the order of 10% all the way up to potentially 90%, which is great. And you know, the way I sort of think of AI, initially when I was teaching big data machine learning, I would put up the Terminator to scare the students. But now I'm thinking of putting up R2-D2 and C-3PO, because you know, this is the AI that's actually going to help.
No, put up a refrigerator, your car, and put up just a plain wall.
Because the students will fall asleep.
Well, yeah, but you know, they'll get used to it, because I mean, this is part of that capability that's happening, you know, the capability to embed the technology into common everyday things. That's where it's going. That's going to be the AI that's more approachable, natural.
Okay, so let's sort of dive a little bit further into where we think these cost savings can come from, right? So, you know, I think it's agreed that this technology will save us money, not only in the government, but also in businesses. But, you know, reducing expenses, increasing productivity sort of was discussed, right? Could you guys give a sense of where do you think, you know, the benefits will really come from? Is it going to be faster processing time for grants? I mean, we talked about tax refunds, maybe voter results. There are some elections that are held on the blockchains.
No, not held on the blockchain. They're being audited.
Audited by the blockchain.
Sure.
Okay, fine. They're being audited by the blockchain. The other thing is, the other thing is, what about sharing data? So for example, allowing data to be shared in a very transparent way, right? So there are a lot of initiatives in order to present this data that's collected by the government and allow users and the public to have access to that data. Unfortunately, some of the data is in different tables all over the place, and there's not sort of a nice way to get the data together, right? So I'm just curious, you know, what do you guys think? You know, you mentioned before, Michael, about chatbots and how some agencies
are using them. Chatbot is like level one. Beyond that is, again, using, and I pulled this up not because I'm a real fan, we'll talk about that offline, but a device to get beyond chat. Right now, chatbot is hi, and it responds to me, and that's pretty much all it can do. What we're trying to get to, technically, is the conversation. Oh yeah, I talked to you last week, and I remember this is your preference. Now you're asking me for something else. Let me use that cognitively, what do you mean here? That I can use that information, refer to it, and make it a conversation. So that's really the key.
Is it more on the processing side? Is it more on the servicing, the taxpayer side, or the customer side, or the citizen side? I mean, where do you think the savings sort of ideally will come from across, you know, the agency?
Sure. So where is this happening? Right now we're at a chatbot stage. I can go on to places like the U.S. Army site. They have a recruiting chatbot. And I can go in and type in, hi, I think I'm interested in becoming a gunnery sergeant, and it'll tell me everything I need to do to get into the Army and become a gunnery sergeant. Great. Customs. We have a chatbot that allows us to just inquire level one inquiries. So what that means is, from a productivity perspective, I can be managing multiple conversations at once from a single desk. So that's more to the productivity and what they're able to handle. So I see that as being number one benefit.
Well, I mean, this takes away the, you know, answering silly questions.
Like, where are the hours of operation? Exactly.
Where can I find this form? If you can have a bot do that, or if you can have, you know, a bot monitor an email system.
Absolutely.
Where it can go ahead and it can respond to this. And then it can respond to those simple questions, where, what's your hours of operation? Where can I find this form? You know, where can you direct me for this? And then if it becomes a question that needs to go to a human, then the email system can direct that email to the correct human. And now you don't need to manage and monitor this general inbox, which saves a ton of time, and it takes away that monotonous following of that email inbox, where it's important and you want to make sure that everybody's questions get answered, but now a human doesn't need to be doing this anymore.
To that point, the one thing I'd make a clarification on, for people old enough to know the IVRs, the voice response system, press one for this, press two for that.
Yeah.
That is so 2000s. No one wants to talk about that. What we're able to do now is much more dynamic because of that technology on the back end, the AI being able to go to the back end systems and say, let me collect this information to produce the answer to your query. So that's huge. The other part, besides it not being IVR, it's not your grandfather's IVR, is that capability of the AI to collect the statistics, go to big data and say, okay, yesterday, what were the top 10 questions about from a taxonomy? Where are those data components that I can mark and add tags to? So tomorrow, when Jose calls up and says, where are my taxes and when do I get my refund? I'm going to know the answer based on those predictive analytics that I put together the day before. So that's going to be yet another way we can save money as a government, save that time, and then also reskill people. You know, this will be part of the human capability, is we will have people that will be trained in this. You know, I went to school at a certain time, I learned certain stuff. I've learned since then because that's what we do as humans. We learn through communication, through verbal communication. We had to learn the old-fashioned way of machine. What's that keystroke? How do I do this? Because that's how the machines understood us. Now the machines are able to understand us better, so we can go back to talk to them normally and use them to our advantage.
I mean, customers in general, I think, have been very forthcoming with providing their data, their information, and when you have an AI layer basically trying to understand this information, what the preferences for the users are, this will basically help understand where the inefficiencies are between the client and basically the service provider. So when you have AI basically embedded, so for example, there's an experiment that was conducted at AI in UX. They asked two groups of people, one group to fill out a form and be completely honest about how they fill out this information, another group to basically misinform this form and basically identify, just line up the name, address, or whatever it is. The AI basically picked up which traits, and it was something as simple as the cursor movement. It picked up that trait to know that how the person filling out this information is actually coming by. So instead of having some sort of forensic accounting or auditing on the back end, you have AI basically picking up these traits and identifying from a security standpoint who's missing, who's misinforming, who's putting out the false information. And you don't need people on the back end filling out or trying to figure out, okay, is this person lying? Is this person creating a fake account? Is this DDoS attack going to happen anytime soon? No, because humans, I mean, they're creatures of habit. Machines, you just have to train your model to basically understand what's been going on, how do we behave, and then we basically translate these findings into insights, and then once someone is lying or creating any inefficiencies or clogging the pipeline, they'll just pick that up and then move on forward. And then that will create a seamless experience for the customers in general because they will know, okay, you're being honest, you're doing what you need to do, you know exactly what you want because of your behavior, you've learned it over time, we're going to deliver immediately. So AI has a lot of potential in terms of like understanding and delivering really quickly. But when it comes to blockchain specifically, that's where information gets retained and information gets distributed. So what I did before during the way was focusing on financial inclusion. And one thing we were trying to do is basically eliminate Western Union. I mean, what they do is plain robbery. I mean, it's really unfair that it's capitalistic, sure, but it's legal robbery. And I mean, there are people that make, you know, they want to send money to their family members, but then why should we pay like $80 for like $1,000 transaction? That is insane. So how do you basically use blockchain technology to eliminate the middleman? Right? Use blockchain to disintermediate the middleman, and this disintermediation is basically getting rid of inefficiencies in the process and redesigning the process, but layering that with AI, but understanding the human needs, their behavior, the patterns, that together will create a seamless report experience end to end.
Do you think that would be a window to get rid of Western Union, or would they just come up with a new business model and say, hey, we'll create our own model, blockchain based, and still be there, but maybe make open source or.
Blockchain itself is distributed and decentralized, but then you have to rely on a central authority, i.e. Western Union, to basically send the money out for you. That's when people start to realize, why should I rely upon just one source? When you have a distributed network, distributed members, when you have interoperating blockchains, you don't have to rely on a single source. So they're going to struggle to basically keep up with these new companies and new startups that are actually trying to help the people save as much money as possible.
She's right. I mean, if Jeff Bezos went to the CEO of Sears and said, hey, I got an idea, do you think he would have funded it? Right? I mean, his model completely disrupts the business of Sears, right? So it's the same, you know, I talk about the remittance market as well when I talk about the triangle of spending money, sending money from the United States to Mexico. Right? So could Western Union reorganize themselves in a manner to compete in that marketplace? Sure. But Western Union would have to work internally to disrupt the way that they've done business since Western Union was formed, whatever year that was. Right? It is a huge, huge cultural change. The difference between if you were employed by a company and you want to try something like this, if you have a centralized IT shop and you want to try blockchain, that's going to be a big uphill battle. But if the IT support is delivered at the program level, where the business owner owns the delivery of services or the collection of information or whatever, it is much easier to disrupt yourself because you're directly attached to a mission space, right? So these are, you know, some of the cultural challenges that you face when you try to do something like that. Yeah, structure, it's the way the organization works.
Yeah, to me, that's one of the biggest changes for government. Is, you know, historically, you have strong CIOs who are really focused on compliance, keeping the lights on, which is not generally an innovative sort of focus. And people that are in program areas, they're connected to the mission. And so it used to be it was really hard to build the tools that they needed in order to get their work done. So they always have to go through the CIO shop, the chief information officer, who's going to give them a long list and a 3-year project in order to get done what they need to get. When you have data that's more freely available, and it's easier to plug things in, it means people that are working on cancer research that are experts in their field can develop what they need quickly, cheaply, and without having to go through all these extra steps. But that really threatens hierarchy that's existed for a long time. And I think that'll be really interesting to see how it kind of plays out over the next, you know, 5+ years. And I'm sure you saw some of that at GSA when you put some of this in place, where people said, wait a second, that's not how you're supposed to do this.
Yes.
Sure.
I mean, sorry to interrupt the flow of there, but it relates to operational inefficiencies. I'm all for removing inefficiencies. My question is more philosophical as to how far do we go into making things efficient? Because I read like Amazon and started using wristwatches that the workers on the workforce,
so they can manage
their hand movements. And if they're not more fast enough, the watcher will nudge them to work faster.
It's a metric.
It's just one company that's using, and there are several others who are using different ways. So how far do we go with efficiency and inefficiency removal? Because we're forgetting that we are the gods on earth, not the machines. The machines are there to support us instead of the other way around. What's happening is that if you don't do this, then get out of the way, we're going to use a robot. Or become a robot. How far are we?
All right, so I want you guys to hold that thought for a second, but it's a very big question. I mean, even in Johns Hopkins, there's a startup, you know, chips on the surgeon's gloves in order to see, you know, which surgeons had better sort of performance, right? So let's hold that, because, you know, that could open up a whole can of worms in terms of, you know, the Internet of Things and sensors and so forth. So I'm going to sort of bring us back to blockchains here. And, you know, I want to sort of discuss, the essence of blockchain is that these nodes are holding copies of data, and it's decentralized, as you guys mentioned. But now, is this going to happen with the U.S. government? Are we going to have this data, our data, or maybe, you know, information about taxes, whatever the government collects on you in terms of information, social security numbers? Are we going to stick this information on a public blockchain? Is it going to be a private blockchain? Is it going to be something in between? How is this going to work out? And, you know, sort of help me think about, you know, if I was running an agency and you said blockchains, and I said, okay, but don't put our data out there all over the place. I don't want to be embarrassed. I don't want to lose my job. So then, you know, how do you deal with the decentralization? And that's one of the four, you know, components of blockchain, right? And, you know, how will agencies think about it? How do we sort of, you know, implement this, right? And will we have one of the chains to stay outside of the public where people can just read only to see see the information to be transparent? I mean, what are your thoughts on that aspect?
First and foremost, in doing our proof of concept, government's in a very unique position to execute because we make the rules. Right? Yeah, we actually...
Courts make the rules.
We write legislation that drives rules, courts interpret those rules, and you know, they may disagree or they may agree, but the rules are kind of made up of the giant dome, wherever that is. So when you make the rules, you are actually kind of setting the terms and conditions for how we're going to operate. And then when we did our implementation, it's very clear that we would use a permissioned blockchain.
Right.
So we could say, if you want to do business with us, this is the way that we're going to do business on the basis of regulation that's in place. Now, does that mean some regulation that will have to change? Yes, but I'm not going to go and try to put something on a non-permission network when I haven't even figured out and nobody has built a non-permission network in the entire public space. So I think that the initial implementations will be permission blockchains, where you take the fact that you set the rules and you use that as a way to construct how you're going to operate and interact with the public.
You won't participate to be part of it.
We aren't in a situation where most of government services are not in a situation where you don't know the counterpart, right? The people that I do business with, I do validation and verification checks directly from the IRS, directly from SAM.gov. I don't actually need SAM.gov anymore, but I can get the information directly from IRS, but there are ways that I can verify and validate that you exist, right? So I think that the starting point is understanding the difference between non-permission and permission-based blockchains and understanding that within a federal agency, you fundamentally control how you're going to do business, and it's driven by regulation. And policy drives how you implement that regulation.